This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
نحمده ونستعين ونستغفره ونؤمن به توكل عليه ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له أما بعد. So today, inshallah, we begin a new series of khutbas on the topic of understanding God's law, the Sharia. And I believe it's a very important discussion that needs to be had. Because when I talk to people on the ground, it becomes very clear that most Muslims do not know what the Sharia is. Most Muslims in our community do not know how the Sharia works. And they have a very bizarre understanding of what life under Sharia would be like. And this is understandable. It's understandable for a number of reasons. Number one, we haven't had a Khilafat for over 100 years. None of us have seen a working model of the Sharia in our lifetime. For people who are born into this modern world and who have not experienced anything outside of modernity, it's difficult for them to visually conceptualize what life would be like under a different system. And even the attempts at reviving Sharia in our lifetime have often been by those who misunderstood it. The most extreme case being the so-called Islamic State that came about in Syria a decade ago. What they applied was nothing to do with Sharia. It was a complete misinterpretation of Sharia. And because of cases like that, the word became even more loaded. So the purpose of this series of khutbas is simply to re-educate ourselves on what the Sharia is, how it works, and to visualize what life under Sharia is really like. Because if we as an ummah ever hope to see the Sharia and the Khilafat revived in our lifetime, it's not going to be possible if we don't even understand these concepts. If our understanding of this concept is so wrong. So looking at what went wrong in our times, right? Number one, the Khilafat ended 100 years ago. The final Ottoman Caliphate came to an end in 1924. There has not been any real Sharia land for the past 100 years. Yes, there are about four countries today that claim to follow the Sharia: Saudi Arabia, Brunei, Iran, and Afghanistan. But even in these four, there are misunderstandings of the Sharia and how it is applied. At least some countries are trying though, compared to others. And I think the biggest cause of our misunderstandings of what the Sharia is the works of the Orientalists in the 20th century and the Islamophobia industry in the 21st century, which sadly, many Muslims have adapted an understanding of the Sharia from those works, right? So what happens is the non-Muslims say, oh, Sharia is oppressive. Sharia is tyrannical, right? And the Muslim minds ends up being, yes it is, we're going to revive that, right? So instead of academically countering their arguments, we buy into their arguments, we buy into their picture of what the Sharia looks like. And anyone who studied history, it becomes very clear that life under Sharia was very different from what the Orientalists and the Islamophobes want us to believe. Life under Sharia was very different. And this is why, again, it's important for us to know our history, which is another reason why people don't understand the Sharia today. This is a blind spot in our Islamic studies curriculums. We don't study history enough. And if we do, we either just study the first generation or we just study the political history. How many of us know about the lives of great ulama throughout history? Or great warriors? How many of us know about the lives of the Sheikhul Islams of the Ottoman Empire? Or the great Qadis of the Abbasid Empire? See, when you study the lives of different people living in different roles, you get a more holistic picture of what life was like under Sharia. You're not just studying one aspect of it. It's important that we educate ourselves on history, because history makes things clear. History makes things clear where the enemies of Islam are lying about what our religion calls for. So today I want to just do a very brief recap of what is Sharia, what did it look like historically, and just refute one of the main arguments made against Sharia by the West, which is that we hate their freedoms and we want to take away freedom, right? This is the big phrase they use about why Muslims are evil and why Islam is evil. They say, oh, they hate our freedoms. I don't even know what that means, hate our freedoms. I don't think there's any Muslim anywhere in the world sitting back, leaning on their couch and saying, yeah, I hate those people's freedoms. Right? What does that even mean? But nonetheless, the idea is that the Sharia is against freedom. I'm going to show that we have a different understanding of freedom. Right? It's not that we are against freedom. It's that we are against public sin. That's what we're against, public sin. Not against freedom. But I'm jumping ahead. Let's get down to basics. What is the Sharia? The Sharia has different meanings in different conversations. Its main meaning is God's law or God's way of life, right? The word Sharia is interchangeable with the word Deen, that this is the way of life that God wants us to follow. When people today think of the word Sharia, they think primarily about criminal law, right? Primarily about chopping off hands and stoning people, which, as you will see as we go deeper into the series, this is an aspect of our law that was very rarely applied. In the Ottoman Empire, only one case was stoning in 500 years. 500 years, just one case of stoning. It's a very rarely applied thing, but that's what they imagine Sharia to be. That's just like not even 1% of Sharia, right? Or they imagine Sharia just to be war and fighting. In reality, when you pray 5 times a day, you are following the Sharia. When you fast the month of Ramadan, you are following the Sharia. When you make nikah the Islamic way, and you run your home the Islamic way, and you raise your children the Islamic way, you are following the Sharia. The Sharia simply means God's way of life. The way that Allah wants us to live. And yet there is a direct clash between Sharia and secularism. Because in secularism, religion should not interfere with public life. And religion should not interfere with politics. But in Islam, we believe the Sharia is holistic. That God has a way that He wants us to live in every aspect of our lives, especially the public life and including politics. And this is why Sharia and secularism are incompatible. Because there is a direct clash in the philosophies. One philosophy is we don't want religion in the public life. The other philosophy is God tells us what to do in every aspect of our lives. So there's a clash here. So the Sharia is God's way of life, right? The way of life that Allah has revealed for us to live by. And the interpretation of the Sharia is done by the ulama. It's on three levels. You have the fuqaha, the jurists who interpret the Quran and Sunnah and write the books of fiqh. Then you have the muftis who answer the questions of people. Whenever something new comes up, they take it to a mufti, and a mufti will do ijtihad and try and arrive at a conclusion. And then you have the qadi, the officially appointed judge, who will judge between the people and whose verdicts are binding. Now, here's the area where a lot of people completely misunderstand the Sharia. When people hear the word Sharia and Khilafat, they imagine one man who has absolute power, right? Imagine one man who has absolute authority over the entire Muslim world. The reality is that the Khilafat was more of a decentralized form of leadership. Aside from the early years, there was no point in our history beyond the first generation where the Khalifa really had absolute power. Even in the first generation, the first generation of Khalifas were humble enough to show us this, that Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu used to tell people, if I am wrong, correct me. Even if you have to correct me with your sword. Right? Umar radiallahu anhu, when he was the Khalifa, he would be delivering a khutbah in the masjid, and a woman would stand up in the masjid and correct him, and he would accept correction. We have cases in the early years of the Khalifa being taken to court, and the qadi ruling against him, and him being forced to follow that law. So this clearly shows us that even from the very beginning, there's no absolute power to one individual. Even the position of the Khalifa is more of a It's a role that has specific reasons behind it. And somebody could be taken out of that role if they are not doing a good job. You know, during the Ottoman era, for example, they developed a policy that the Sheikhul Islam, if he felt that the Khalifa is not doing a good job, he could write a fatwa declaring that that person be removed as Khalifa and somebody else take his place. And this happened many times during the Ottoman era. When there were alcoholics or drug addicts who ended up as Khalifas, the Sheikhul Islam would write a fatwa, this man not suitable for the position. The army would remove him and then put one of his cousins or brothers in his place. So this clearly shows us there's no one person who has absolute power in the Khilafat. Rather, what you will find is that power in the Khilafat is distributed on many levels. The Khalifa himself, his primary role is number one to protect the borders, to protect the Muslims. The jihad is something that he is in charge of. The expansion and the protection of the Muslim borders and ensuring that Muslims are able to live in peace and everyone living in those borders are able to live in peace. His role is also to facilitate the Sharia. Meaning, his job is simply to make sure that people in his lands are able to live by Sharia. He doesn't interpret the Sharia himself, he doesn't invent the Sharia himself, he doesn't actually have a say in what the Sharia is. His role is simply to make sure people are able to live by the Sharia. There's actually in the Islamic Empire a separate power structure that was in charge of the law, and that was the ulama. That you had the Shaykh al-Islam, you had the Qadi, you had the Muftis. They interpreted the law. They told the people what was right and what was wrong, what was halal and what was haram. And they could even hold the Khalifa accountable based on these laws. And the Khalifa simply, his role was to allow the Sharia to be facilitated and to ensure that the Muftis and the Qadis were the most capable people for those roles. And to pay them the salary so they could fulfill their roles. But on a day-to-day basis, the average person living under the Khilafat would not have any interaction with the government at all. If they had a question, they go to the Mufti. If they wanted to study, they go to their local sheikh. If they had a dispute with their neighbor or their friends or their family members, they would go to the Qadi. The actual application of Sharia was done by the ulama. And so this was a separate level of power. And there were other levels of power as well. So for example, under Sharia, the head of the household has actual power. He has actual authority over the people of his household, separate from the government. We find this hard to understand today, because governments have absolute power today, right? But if you look, for example, there are many cases in our history where a young man wants to go for jihad, and his father says no, and the ruler of the region says, you have to listen to your father. He's the head of the household, it's his decision, not yours, right? That the head of the household has actual authority. The tribal chief would have authority. The local governor would have authority. And so what you end up with is decentralized authority. If you actually live in a town or a village under the Khilafat, it would be very rare that the government would actually play any role in your life at all. You would simply live your life. You would simply live your life. You would go to work, raise your family, enjoy the peace and security and lack of crime that comes with Sharia. And if you have a problem, you ask your Mufti or you go to your Qadi. This was freedom. This is the Islamic understanding of freedom. Right? That within these boundaries, you're free to live your life. You are a citizen anywhere where Muslims live. You don't have to be a citizen to a specific region. You don't need a passport to travel from one Muslim land to another. You have freedom. You have freedom to do anything besides public sin. See, this is the one area now where the clash comes in and why people today look at the Sharia as being against freedom. Because when they think of freedom, they think of the freedom to publicly sin, right? They think of the freedom of promoting sin. And they think of the freedom of doing whatever you want, whenever you want. Under Sharia, if you committed a sin in the privacy of your home, it's nobody's business besides you and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's actually a sin on people to spy on you. It's a sin for people to peek into your homes. It's a sin for people to try and find out what's going on in people's private lives. So people would stick to their own lives. But the minute a sin becomes public, someone is publicly a thief, a drug dealer, a fornicator, now this is a matter of public safety. Now this is a matter of protecting the dignity and the honor of the public. This is where the Sharia would now have some strict rules to prevent this from happening. So for people who assume that the Sharia is all about restrictions, I will counter this and say there are actually very few restrictions in the Sharia. Very few. The amount of major sins are less than 2 dozen. And things that are minor sins, the government doesn't enforce it. It's something that's simply a matter of advising people. Right? The only areas where the government would enforce things under Sharia are things that are considered crimes. Things that are considered crimes in the sight of God. And this would be, for example, stealing, murder, fornication, adultery. In Islam, fornication and adultery, or rather public fornication and public adultery, are considered crimes, not personal sins. These are areas where there's criminal law. But the average person doesn't want to steal. The average person doesn't want to murder. The average person has no interest in fornication and adultery. They want to live a happy married life. And so the average person would be happy under Sharia. The average person would be happy with Sharia law. And the average person would feel free under Sharia. And I'll end with one last point. Sharia gave so much autonomy and freedom to communities that if you look, for example, in the Ottoman Empire, you would find entire cities and towns that were Christian or Jewish, where even the Adi would be a rabbi or a priest ruling by their law. Because that's the level of religious freedom that the Sharia gave. That Christians and Jews were able to have their own neighborhoods run by their own laws, where they could completely follow their religion, right down to the letter of the law. There's no place on earth today that gives any religion that level of freedom. So who really is free? Those under Sharia or those under modernity? And therefore I say this idea that Sharia is about restricting freedoms, this is a lie. This is a lie based on a very specific false illusion of freedom that the West is promoting. In reality, for those who wish to live a good life, for those who want social cohesion, for those who want justice, those who want peace, those who want a crime-free society, Sharia provides the best set of laws to make that a reality in this world. And this is something we all need to think about when we are conceptualizing the Sharia in our minds. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillah rabbil alameen. Alhamdulillah wa anta wassalatu wassalamu ala man la nabiyya ba'da amma ba'da. One of the main problems between clashes between modernity and Islam is this concept of freedom, where they think that we hate their freedom and we want to take away their freedoms and we have a problem with freedom. In reality, many of the ulama actually have listed freedom as one of the goals of the Sharia. One of the goals of the Sharia is that people are free to live good lives. And the only restrictions are on crimes and public sins. And this is where the clash comes in. Modernity has created an illusion of freedom. What do I mean by an illusion of freedom? They tell you if you're living in the modern world, you are free. You can drink alcohol, you can take drugs, you can fornicate, you can be homosexual, you can do whatever you want. But this is an illusion. You are free to sin. You are free to live a hedonistic lifestyle. You're not really free though. If you, for example, had to preach against the LGBTQ lifestyle, and you had to become quite popular and influential, modern governments could spread a slander about you, leading to cancel culture, leading to your entire life being ruined. Worse than that, they can freeze your bank accounts, they can seize your passport, they can throw you in jail. There's nothing you can do about it. Is this really freedom? Think about how many times has this happened in the past 100 years to people. Is this really freedom? What is this freedom that they talk about? You're free as long as you say what they want and you believe what they want. That's what they call freedom. If you have any beliefs different from what they believe, if you have any ideas different from what they believe, then they have ways of oppressing you. They have ways of suppressing you. This is why the freedom of modernity is just an illusion. As long as you are drunk with sin and lost in the world of sin, the governments are happy. Because you're not questioning things. You're not thinking too deeply about things. They can do what they want. They can get away with what they want. And by the way, they have made laws today so restrictive and so convoluted that every single person on earth has committed crimes without knowing it. And they have ways of showing that. They have ways of showing, oh, a certain year you didn't really pay your taxes properly, or you made a mistake in your taxes. I'm going to hold you accountable for that. Oh, you crossed the road at the wrong spot. The government's going to hold you accountable for that. Oh, when you were a teenager, you downloaded a movie illegally. The government's going to hold you accountable for that. And they don't really hold people accountable for these things unless they need to. But they made life so restricted, they come up with so many laws, that if they don't like someone, if they don't like what somebody has to say, if they don't like how influential somebody is, they can go through their entire life history, find somewhere down the line where they violated a law unknowingly, and hold them accountable for it. And so, I firmly believe that these same people today who say that the Sharia restricts your freedom, they are the ones who restrict freedom. They are the ones who have power to take freedom away from people. And many of us today are unable to think outside of this modern structure. We assume that because governments today have so much power, we assume that's the way the world has always been. But this is a very recent product. This is a very recent form of leadership. For the bulk of our history, the average Muslim lived in towns and villages where the government had no influence over them at all. The tribal chief or the head of that village, they would be the one in charge, and everybody else, you know, would follow them. And as long as they were living by Sharia, and as long as they were peaceful people, the government did not get involved in their lives at all. And for those of you who want to understand this topic a bit further, I would highly recommend two books by Dr. Wael Hallaq. One is an introduction to Islamic law, and the other is called The Impossible State. For anyone who does not understand why there's a clash between the modern state system and Sharia, and why Sharia is better than the modern state system in every possible way, Dr. Wael Hallaq's beautiful work, The Impossible State, is worth reading. Because in this book, he shows over and over again why the modern state system is incompatible with Islam, simply because the modern state system gives too much power to the government, and under Sharia, the government's not supposed to have that much power. And how under Sharia, the laws are from God, in the modern state system, the laws are from people. It's a very powerful book, and I highly recommend everybody reads it and thinks about it. I also highly recommend our local bookstore start stocking it, right? So you don't have to get it any other way. So this is something for us to think about. For anyone who is of this idea that the Sharia is against freedom, I would argue that number one, what is your definition of freedom? If your definition of freedom is you want to commit whatever sins you want, wherever you want, then I'll say yes. Allah doesn't like that. Allah doesn't like public sin. Allah does not want us to live a life of public sin. That's not a bad thing. A community and a society where sin is kept private and shameful and hidden is the most productive society. If your definition of freedom is a life where the government doesn't interfere too much in your life, where you can run whatever business you want and do whatever job you want and run your family the way you want, as long as whatever you're doing is not haram, then the Sharia is freedom. The Sharia is freedom. It all depends on how you define the word. So that's our first point that we covered today, to help us realign our minds to understanding the Sharia. There are many other misconceptions that people have about the Sharia, and we'll take them step by step, one khutbah at a time, as we try and rebuild in our image a proper understanding of what is the Sharia. I hope that today's lecture just gave you a lot of food for thought about what is freedom, what is the real freedom, what is the freedom we should be seeking, and which system of law actually gives us that freedom. Wa akhiru da'wana, and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Aqim as-salam.
Thank you.